Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Gemma, and welcome to another episode of Good Influence. This is the podcast where each week you and I meet a guest who will help us pay attention to something we should know about, as well as answering some of your questions. This week, we're talking about sabotage, the micro and macro ways that we get in our own way, how online spaces can cultivate a negative mindset, and learning to analyse our own behaviour. So joining me this week is Emma Gannon. Emma is a best-selling author, speaker, teacher, and podcaster. She started her podcast Control-Alt-Delete in 2016 and has since had over 10 million downloads. She's so far published 5 books, including her debut novel, Olive, released in 2020, as well as The Multi-Hyphen Method, discussing modern careers, Disconnected, about our relationships with online media, and crucially for today, Sabotage, a book about overcoming the barriers we put up in the way of our own happiness.
Your life is like almost like a crime scene, and you need to almost find the root of the crime. Like, where did it happen? What happened? And like, how do we go about solving it?
We're here to talk about sabotage today, which not only, you know, is a thing that we do in our lives, it's also the title of a book that you published. So the full title, Sabotage, How to Silence Your Inner Critic and Get Out of Your Own Way. How did you come to writing a book on this topic? Because, I mean, as someone who's, you know, even just followed you online for a number of years, I look at you and I think, Emma, she's a very, you know, confident, successful person. I wouldn't have looked at you and thought you were someone who sabotaged yourself. But yeah, how did you come to writing the book?
That is what a lot of people have been saying to me, actually, is, and I guess in my 20s, because I wrote Sabotage in 2019, so I was 29, and I was really coming to the end of my 20s, where I think, like a lot of people in that decade, you are quite focused on the outward projection of life. Like, I was not performing, but I was showing the shiny bits big time in my career, especially. Yeah. And I'm good at that. Like, I've worked in social media marketing for like my whole life. Like, I know how to make things like look good, sound good, post a good picture, write a good caption. I would do that for brands, and then I was sort of doing it for myself. And it was weird because I went into my 30s realizing that actually I just really wanted to write more personally. And Sabotage, the book, was the first time I opened up, I think. And people were like, oh, wow, you're being really honest in this book. But I just felt really ready to. And what was interesting about the topic of sabotage is, you know, I'm not a psychotherapist. I don't have qualifications in terms of dealing with people's mental health and trauma and all that stuff. But what I do have, I think, is an ability, hopefully, to write about my own personal experiences and also interview people. And the sort of journalist in me can hopefully tie together this theme and make it accessible for people who are struggling. So in the book, you know, it is experts telling me what to do. I'm like the guinea pig, because I did self-sabotage. I really couldn't enjoy any of the success I had made for myself. I was trying to mess it up because I wasn't comfortable having it.
What did that look like for you in terms of, so when you look back and you think, oh, I was sabotaging myself at that time, was it sort of turning things down or just kind of talking to yourself negatively? What was that like?
Yeah, it was a combination of a few of those. The big one was talking myself out of exciting opportunities, just being like, oh no, I don't want to do that, when really I was just scared. That was a huge one. So I suppose that was like imposter syndrome stuff. But the other one was, it wasn't like a huge deal because I could very much put a mask over it, but I would sort of like turn up to meetings like slightly groggy and hungover. And it's like a difficult one to talk about because now it has a terminology. It's called like grey area drinking, when like you're probably just having like a couple of glasses of wine. No one would be like, oh, that's a problem for you. in fact, everyone around me was like, that's really not a problem, you're fine. But I was like, no, I am sabotaging myself here because I'm numbing out feelings, good and bad. And I'm just not showing up as like the fullest version of me. And for me, that's what self-sabotage means. It's like, you're just sort of like dimming your light a little bit every day. And you're just kind of being smaller than you perhaps could be in the world. And also, you know, I talk about this in the book, we might get onto it, but self-sabotage also isn't about turning it into like a punishment of like, I'm a terrible person, I do this, I mess up. Mm. It's more like, ooh, look at the behaviors you're doing and what could you do to maybe make your life easier?
That kind of makes me think about the sort of, do you think there's been quite a mindfulness sort of element to it, which I know is like a little bit of a buzzword now, but you know, the idea of being more aware of your own thoughts. Because I guess if other people were looking at your behavior from the outside and didn't, you know, see a problem, did it take quite a lot for you to really sort of turn the gaze inwards and think, well, if nobody thinks that this behavior is a problem, really having to look at your own sort of motivation for that behavior and be aware of your own, yeah, your own inner workings in order to see where it was actually going wrong?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, what I've realized now, one of the most unhelpful things of friends and family to do is if you say, this thing is troubling me, or I think this is a problem for me, the worst thing is someone going, no, it's not, you're fine, because you're invalidating someone's feelings. And, you know, someone could be listening to this and be like, I think it's a problem that, you know, I don't like going out past midnight. Like, that just makes me feel anxious and scared and I don't like it. And someone going, you don't need to change that, that's fine. And it's just these little things. And really, what that's what sabotage the book is about. It's like, it can be so minor, but if it's if it's troubling you, it's valid and it's important, and you are allowed to look at that and question that. And also just question how you want to live your life in a society of normal kind of norms, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's interesting, I think, just in terms of like prioritizing your own feelings and the kind of like gut feelings, it sounds like. Because I think, I mean, I can relate to, yeah, what you're saying, where you feel like something might be a problem and other people, and I think it's always quite well-meaning. I think it's in the same vein of where you say something's a problem and either people will say, no, it's fine, it's not a problem, or will be like, oh, I do that too, it's no big deal, kind of thing, which then is kind of like, oh, well, am I making a big deal about nothing? And when you're kind of trying to improve things for yourself, it makes it a little more difficult.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's the same sort of thing around someone saying like, I feel sad, or I feel depressed, or I feel unhappy, and someone's going, oh, but you're doing really well, you're fine. And it's like, you literally just want someone to be like, that sounds really shit, how can I help? Or just like, oh, right. And just literally just accepting what you're saying. But it's interesting, because I wrote Sabotage quite a few years ago, it feels like, in my head, because it came out, I think it came out like a few months after the first lockdown, which honestly feels like so long ago to me now. And so so much more work in this area since I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. But it's still a little companion, I feel, to a lot of the stuff that I want to write about, because there's so many like basic reminders in there.
Yeah, I mean, reading the book, so I read Sabotage on holiday earlier this year and have like re-kind of acquainted myself with it before we recorded today. But there's one thing I thought was, there are a lot of kind of practical tips in there. So as you go through and kind of discuss your own journey with this topic, it's really like punctuated with quite either practical or kind of thought exercises on how to stop doing this. How did you kind of go about collating that information? Did you find it was really helpful to you while writing it to speak to all these different experts and things, or is it, you know, then a mixture of things that you came up with, or where did all your tips come from?
That's a really good question. I mean, I interviewed quite a lot of people and then I kind of narrowed it down to what I thought would be helpful. But I also, over the years of writing about work and careers, lots of the same questions kept coming up. And even though this book is more lifestyle related, when I wrote The Multi-Hyphen Method, and that was in 2017, all the questions I got from young women were like, I'm a perfectionist, I procrastinate, I can't self-promote, and I have a horrible inner critic. And those are like the four things that kept coming up. time and time again. And so that's really the chapters in the book, is like those four themes. And so I'm, you know, for example, I'm not a perfectionist. I'm actually the opposite. I just like throw things out there and see what happens. Mm. But I really felt like that was something I wanted to tackle because other people were saying that. But there are little anecdotes in there that I tried to make quite funny. Like there's one about how I haven't driven a car since I was 18 because my whole family would basically take the piss out of me. And like, it was literally the biggest family joke that like Emma, you know, can't drive, and like, oh, can't believe we're all still alive because we've been in the car with Emma. And it's like, I never got into any scraps. Mm. I actually was a fine driver, but I haven't driven for literally 15 years because of a silly joke. Yeah. And so I'm trying to, you know, make light of that, but also I am trying to get back in a car soon. But it's the power of people putting things onto you, these stories that people make of you,
yeah,
from even back when you're a child. And God, we need to like shake them off somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting that you say about those kind of four different areas, and you go into that in the book where, you know, people had sent in the stories and you felt like it was quite easy to categorize. Could you tell us a little bit more about those four different kind of areas? Like how is this self-sabotage showing up in people's lives? What does that look like?
Well, what's interesting about the four categories is even though they're all slightly different, they're all based in fear. So with procrastination, you know, we all know what that is when you have something you really need to do and you'll find any way to kind of, yeah, skirt around it, organize your sock drawer, call a friend, you know, do horrible admin. You don't want to do anything to not do this creative project you have wanted to do for years, maybe. And it's really, really difficult. But really at the heart of that is like you're normally also quite scared to start. So you'll make the excuses. Perfectionism is very similar to procrastination, but it's kind of different because with perfectionism, you are actually doing the thing, but you could be doing it endlessly and not showing anyone ever because you're scared of anyone seeing it. Inner critic is also fear-based because we just think, who am I to even try this thing? And then fear of self-promotion is similar. It's I'm scared what people will think of me. So they're all interlinked and they're all based in fear. And this is the thing about self-sabotage is it's actually quite a sweet thing that our brain does. It's like trying to protect us. It's like, that's scary, don't do that. But we've got confused somewhere along the line that like publishing a book is the same level of fear as like being attacked by a bear, and it's not.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I love all that kind of psychology stuff. Like I was reading something the other day about what they call negativity bias, which is kind of that, you know, very human trait of always paying more attention to the kind of more negative things. And yeah, so you know, say we read 100 nice comments and one negative one, we focus on the negatives. And it was talking about the possible sort of evolutionary basis there, where back, you know, however long ago in our ancestors, it was people who were very aware of the negative and aware of danger who were more likely to survive, and therefore they have passed down all their worrisome traits to us who now exist in the real world. So I mean, I think we've had a conversation similar to that maybe on the podcast in the past where we talk about anxiety and how, you know, it's really, while not very helpful at all, it's kind of trying to keep us safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it reminds me a little bit of something in the book that's one of my favorite bits, which is about the sunken cost fallacy, which is about how when you put so much into something, it's really hard to quit because you're basically sabotaging yourself by like staying in it. So basically, if you've had a job for like 20 years, the reason you don't quit is because you're like, I've put 20 years into this.
Yeah.
Same with relationships. Mm-hmm. And that, again, is a safety mechanism because your brain is like, but you've put all the work in, stay in the safe. But actually, we need to take risks.
Yeah, when actually it's not always the best thing to do. How have you found thinking about sabotage in a kind of micro, macro kind of way? Because in my head, it kind of reverts to two different sort of situations. One being, as you said, the kind of small day-to-day things, which is a little bit like we talked in the first episode of this series was about self-care with Grace Victory. And we had a bit of a chat about, you know, what are the small things that we keep doing even though they make us feel terrible? And I feel like that's maybe examples of the like lower level sabotage. But there's also quite a lot of discussion then about how we sabotage ourselves when we're looking at bigger kind of like life goals and things like that, whether it's, you know, career goals or dreams that people are chasing. Do you think the sabotage in those different areas kind of comes from the same place? Does it look the same? How does it sort of manifest when it is these bigger goals and dreams and things that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because they're basically the same things. Mm. Like when you change your life on the smallest, most micro scale, that is when you do achieve the huge dreams, I believe. And I've done quite a lot of work recently with Lydia Johnson, who's a hypnotherapist. She's like from the London Clinic of Hypnotherapy. Okay. And she really broke down to me, because I've had quite a lot of hypnotherapy, around the first 20 minutes of your day basically sets you up for the whole day. And I never really knew that, because I wake up in quite a bad mood because I'm not a morning person.
Same.
And without realizing, I was just sabotaging my whole day in the first 20 minutes without even realizing that that's what I was doing. And by chance, I'd sometimes wake up in a good mood and I would have a really good day. And it was this amazing realization that, and it sounds cheesy and it sounds cliche and, you know, quite basic, but your thoughts really do have the power to change your whole day, which has the power to change your whole year, which has the power to change your whole life. Like the minute I saw that, I started sorting my mornings out and dealing with the thoughts that would then spiral into feelings and behavior, like my whole life has changed. Like friends from the past have got back in touch. Jobs that I've always wanted have come into my life and I've accepted them for the first time. Ideas come to me more easily. Like this is kind of wild, because it's like, if I told you it's because I've changed 20 minutes of my day, how do all those things then come from that?
Yeah, I mean, that also sounds like a magical life hack, though, if it's 20 minutes of change.
And it's not easy.
Oh, no. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I know. And that's a small print, isn't it? Because what I just said does sound easy. But changing your thoughts daily takes a lot of work. And actually, I think a lot of that happened during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I'm really noticing that, even though it was awful, and we obviously don't need to go into details about how that was like the worst thing, for a lot of people, it gave them some time to sort themselves out as well, mentally.
Yeah. I mean, practically, what does that 20 minutes now look like? Is it a thing about, you know, recognizing your thoughts and deciding to sort of set the day up positively? Or is it physical habits that you had changed?
Physical, yeah. So kind of back to what I was saying about, like, you know, that even the night before is going to impact the morning. So it's like you kind of have to go back a few steps. So it's like, am I having a good evening the night before? Like, am I going to bed at a time when I want to? Not drinking. This all sounds very boring, but, you know, I really came to a time where I was like, these things really matter to me right now in my life. Yeah. And so if I want to wake up and feel really fresh and like feel really motivated at this time in my career and my life, there's things I have to change. And it is that stuff. It is like, put your phone away for like half an hour before you get into bed. I don't check my phone in the mornings anymore. I also was inspired by someone called Donna Lancaster. I don't know if you've heard of her, but she is incredible. She's a coach and she has a book coming out soon, actually. But she talks a lot about the power of dancing and music.
Okay.
And so she did this challenge where, like, you should dance every day, even for like one song. That has changed my mood like a crazy amount.
Okay.
So it's really tiny. It's, and like, you know, obviously going for the daily walk or even going outside for 10 minutes to go to like the shop to get milk, like leave the house. Mm. Yeah, it's a lot of these tiny, tiny things, but they really set me up, I think.
I love that. I'm going to be thinking about dancing around the house at different points now just to see if it helps my day, you know? So talking about, there's a few different things that you talk about in the book, and I feel like they obviously all link together very well, but talking about technology and social media and our phones and all of that kind of stuff that links together and might be sort of encouraging that negative sort of mindset about ourselves and about our achievements. Could you tell us a bit about that? So how do you think, or how have you found in your research that this technology might be encouraging the sort of self-sabotaging behavior.
Yes. Well, in Disconnected, the book that I wrote after this, and they're kind of two small books come together, I really wanted to look at kind of the elephant in the room, which is we talk about social media and digital culture like it's kind of wildly separate, like this thing that we analyze separately from everything else. But at the same time, it's sort of, it's still a way to escape and it's still a way to numb out sometimes. Like the way that people scroll and I scroll when my eyes glaze over and I'm completely out of my own head and into the phone and I'm watching other people's lives on repeat. It's quite similar to kind of drowning your sorrows in other ways. You're kind of out of your own body and you're out of your own mind. And so when we think about how much time we're spending on our phones, like I don't want to make anyone feel guilty. I don't want to make myself feel guilty. Some of these apps that tell you how long you're spending on your phone, I'm like, can you not tell me I could have run a marathon while scrolling tonight, please? Like, they're so annoying. But when it comes to kind of creativity and accessing your own wisdom and accessing your own self, our phone is taking that away a little bit. But not always, because obviously we know that community is amazing on Instagram. We know that we can make friendships online. We know that we can have the career of our dreams from the from the way that we use the internet. So it's like, how do we change it from being active in our use rather than passive?
Yeah.
And that's the same for all these things that I've just mentioned. Like, are you actively choosing what you want to eat or drink or what music you want to listen to or what time you want to go to bed? I don't think a lot of us are that active with our phones. I think we just consume almost like what is the norm or like what we've been following for the last 10 years. But I think unsubscribing and like changing that up every now and again is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I read an interview with you about Sabotage, the book as well. And you were talking about this whole idea of sometimes we're chasing goals and feeling like we're sabotaging ourselves and sabotaging our own dreams. And you said that sometimes you think we do that because the goal that we're chasing, we don't actually want it. We're only going after it because we think it'll look good to other people. And that kind of tying that into social media and thinking that, oh, well, I have to do this thing because other people are doing it or because that'll look good online or look impressive.
Yes.
And then, yeah, kind of the idea that, that's why we don't put everything into it. So we'll feel guilty for not doing it, but you didn't actually want it in the first place. I thought that was a really interesting point.
Yes. And it's interesting, those two things, though, because they sit side by side. So, for example, if you are numbing out and like really escaping your life and just like miserable because you, didn't get that job that you wanted, that could be because you really, really wanted it. And that feeling will be like real sort of genuine sort of sadness and disappointment. Whereas if you kind of sabotage the interview because you didn't even want the job anyway, but you just felt like maybe it would please your parents, you'll kind of feel like a relief alongside the numbing out. So they're slightly different. And I think this is why the books and all podcasts, like there's like an element of nuance to every conversation.
Of course, because
we are also living in like a self-help kind of universe of gurus galore who are claiming to have the answer.
Yeah.
And I just think we got to really dig quite deep, I think, to kind of be our own kind of compass, because especially in like the sort of American culture of, you know, people on stage with a Britney mic, like telling you how to live your life. It's like,
yeah,
I worry that that's becoming, is going too far.
Right. So what do the good and bad versions of that look like to you then? Because I guess in terms of, I don't know, I've never particularly thought of, you know, self-help and that cultural thing as a very bad thing. As in, like, I think it's great when, you know, people are reading books that help them understand their own mind a bit better and are trying to sort of maybe figure out and change these behaviors that they think are keeping them down. But then equally, yeah, as soon as you say that and kind of picture the image of, I don't know, someone like really preaching to people that they've got like the answer and the secret to a happy life, what's the kind of, yeah, what's the good medium in that? Like, where should we be learning these kind of things from, if not, you know, from people who tell us they've got it all figured out. Who should we be looking to?
That's the thing. It's like, that's why I kind of write about my own anecdotes and kind of my own life. And I feel like, hopefully at the beginning and at the end, I'm always caveating it with like, this might have worked for me, this might not work for you. And also, there is no one size fits all. So if you're sabotaging in some way, there is something so juicy and interesting to unpick there. And you are at the start of a journey of getting to know yourself and like discovering yourself. And like that really excites me. But I think it's dangerous to be like, well, this is sabotage for this reason. This is the way out. And I think that's why the nuance of this book hopefully encourages people to go, okay, cool, thanks so much for all these tools, but now I've got to go and work out what's really going on. Yeah. And I'm a really big fan of coaching and life coach. I've had a life coach for the past 2 years, and I know that term, like, people roll their eyes at that a little bit, but essentially it's just someone like cheerleading you and also helping you unpick all these things. So I think a book can really change your life, don't get me wrong, but I also think that this is like daily work. And I think I used to get disappointed where I would read a book and be like, right, okay, where's my new life?
Yeah.
And I realized that actually there's like a lifetime of work to continue doing, but it can be really enjoyable as well.
Yeah. I'm interested to know if, you know, during the course of interviewing lots of people and kind of researching for the book, did you end up kind of speaking to anyone, or did you find there were people who were like, no, I don't do that. Like, I don't sabotage myself. Or do you think it is quite a universal human experience? Like, is it something we all do?
It's a good question. I mean, I know plenty of people that really don't.
Mm.
I know so many people who don't overthink. They don't analyze How? Things over and over and over again. Like, people are just like, yeah, water off a duck's back, not bothered by that. And I love those people. Like, I am surrounded by people like that. But I also feel like when it comes to creativity and writing, you should always feel like you have something to say if you feel like you do, because you will find your audience, you'll find your community. And like, all the people that read my books, they're very, I feel, quite similar people. Mm. People that kind of want to break through. They want to go through to this next chapter of their life. They want to make things. And that excites me. So people, yeah, some people will be like, oh God, I really don't need this book.
I mean, this is the thing. And I'm like, that is one of the things that I find really fascinating when you look at these kind of social, I don't know, patterns of behavior, I guess, and things that a lot of people do. Because like you say, this is what we love this about other humans, is finding people who feel the same way that we do, and that kind of sense of camaraderie. But I also then find it really interesting to think, well, like, why is that? And why have we, for example, you know, found ourselves in this camp? And I think you said right in the intro to the book, I remember you saying, kind of describing a story and a time when you felt that you were sort of professionally sabotaging yourself, kind of through the fear of not achieving a dream. And I think it was writing your novel you were talking about. But you said in there that when you were having these feelings, you felt like you did as a young child when what was the example you said? I think it was something about, you know, not being picked for a sports team, or that thing, that feeling of kind of failure and like you weren't good enough, and kind of remembering that from childhood. Do you think that's a big way that it plays into it? And is it, you know, is it just people who've had different childhoods maybe have grown up in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, I find that the main message of the book really is that there are so many layers to this, and each one of us is so different, like you were saying, because I always think of it as sort of your life is like almost like a crime scene, and you need to almost find the root of the crime. Like, where did it happen? Mm-hmm. What happened? And like, how do we go about solving it? And, you know, Martha Beck, who's one of my favorite kind of she's like a sociologist. She always says that there's one thought normally that triggers all of the patterns of self-sabotage. Mm. And it can be so subtle. So for example, say mine was comparison, and I was walking down the escalator, and on a advert on the side of the escalator in London, I saw the person I compare myself the most on a poster having a great time. I might then go to my meeting, not really think anything of it, then go home and drink like a bottle of wine. Right. And then have a terrible day the next day and mess up my next meeting. And so I've sabotaged my own life because of something that really bothers me.
Yeah.
And everyone's is different. But now I know what mine is. Mine is related to kind of that sort of childhood thing of like not being picked or being left out or like feeling not good enough, yeah, or a variation of that. And so I'm like, oh, there it is. And I know, and I can stop myself. Mm. And I just don't sabotage anymore. And that makes it sound simple too. But once you realize what that thing is that only you know, you can be like, ah, there it is again. And you can stop yourself in your tracks.
How did you figure that out? Like, is that, how do we do that? Is it really a point of sitting down and thinking, you know, when do I start to feel XYZ, what feeling am I having? Is that something that you, yeah, think people can do by themselves, or do you need to be kind of coached through that?
I think having a coach really helps. Obviously, I, you know, it's not really something everyone can afford or has access to, unfortunately. I really wish this stuff was taught in schools, to be honest, because the you know, that time when you realize what's going on, you're like, oh my god, I'm so glad I realized it now, because some people realize it way later in life. But It is about sort of making note of these feelings. So now, you know, I can actually feel it like in my body. Mm. I'm like, oh, there it is. Like, it's very specific.
Yeah.
And it's like it rises up through me. And I'm like, oh God. I think that's what I'm really trying to get at as well with the Disconnected book, is like, we're not going to work out these things if we're on our phones the whole time.
Right,
and there is nothing wrong with spending time on our phones, but I think what I'm trying to get at is like, if we want to reconnect with like what the hell is going on inside our psyches, mm-hmm, if we want to, that does mean sitting quite uncomfortably, and it's really, there's a real discomfort to it. The when I started to realize like that moment when I was sabotaging, what I wanted to do was not feel it and be like, ah, I don't want to feel this.
Yeah.
But you do have to like sit with it, and it's like, I don't know, it's like, I'm trying to think of an example, when you're at the dentist or something, mm, and you want it to be over, but you're like, I have to sit and I have to let it happen.
Yeah, this is good for me. It's not fun, but it's good for me, and it'll be better afterwards. Fun. Yeah, I get that. So all that being said, if you could kind of, if someone is listening to this and relating to it and thinking, I sabotage myself all the time, I talk myself out of doing things, tell myself I can't do things, tell myself it's all going to go wrong, where could people kind of start with some tips to kind of start on the journey of stopping sabotaging yourself quite so much?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first tip would be to take the smallest step possible, like really tiny, weeny step, because it is a process and it's not an overnight thing. Nothing is. And so instead of that sort of punishment mentality, mm, of like, I did that bad thing again, it's the opposite. It should be, do a tiny thing in the right direction or in the direction you want to go, and celebrate yourself. Like, try and turn that around, try and have that voice that's like, you did that thing, you did it a little bit, that's enough for today.
Yeah.
Tick, like gold star for you. Because this is the spiral of self-sabotage, is like the more kind of, you know, mean you are, the more you'll do it. So that's the first step, really, is breaking that cycle.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Every week, my guest and I will be answering your questions. And the first one comes in from Tamara. And she says, how do you distinguish between self-sabotage and choosing not to pursue a seemingly good opportunity because you feel it might not be the right path for you?
Well, I mean, the way that question is phrased, I would say that sounds like self-sabotage versus self-care. I think turning something down you don't want to do is a really brave an act of putting yourself first and sort of prioritizing your mental health. So yeah, I wouldn't say that's self-sabotage.
I guess it's kind of saying, how do you know whether that's what you're doing? I think is probably the, like, how do you know whether you are taking care of yourself by not doing something, even if other people think it looks good, or if your motivation is actually that you quite would like to do it, but you don't want to mess up? How do you tell the difference between those feelings?
Well, I would say it's similar to earlier, where you will feel different sensations in your body. So if you are saying no to something you really don't want to do, you'll feel relief. You'll feel like, ah, your shoulders will drop. And you'll be like, yes. If you are saying no to something you really want to be doing, you might feel anxious, or you might feel disappointed. You might feel a bit sad. You might feel just like, yeah, like you've kind of gone against your sort of own integrity. And something will feel off. That's how I would tell the difference.
Real gut feeling situation. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're all in our heads so much. And actually, there is a lot that your physical body will tell you.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely. Yeah. I think taking the time to trust the gut feeling, I suppose that's the scary part, isn't it?
Yeah. I find relief a really useful way of indicating, because if I don't feel the relief, I'm like, oh, maybe I did want to do that then. Because we all know that feeling, don't we, of when you get out something you really don't want to do. Like, it feels good.
Yeah. Next question is from Marta. And she says, I often find myself in situations where I start comparing myself to others very easily. Lately, I've noticed I do it more than ever. For example, I never really had a good relationship with my body, and it's got a lot better in the past year. And now I can say that I like my body and I'm okay with it. Now that I'm okay with my body, I've unconsciously started to look for other flaws in myself that other people don't have. It's like I need something to hate about myself. Every time I get past one insecurity, I immediately start to look for another one. Why do I do this, and how can I stop the cycle?
Wow, that is, first of all, very self-aware to even know that that's what's happening. That's actually a really good step to even be like, oh, look, I'm doing this thing where I'm transferring one thing onto another. So to even notice you're kind of doing that behavior as a cycle is, I think, really interesting. I mean, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I really feel like that would be an interesting one to kind of look at, in terms of there must be something where you are feeling less than, and it was almost uncomfortable to like yourself. So I would find that quite, you know, a good one to dig into with maybe some professional help, or even just to notice your thoughts a bit more. Like, where are they coming from? Are they coming from you? Are they coming from an old teacher, an old friend that said, you know, it's like digging into where they came from in the first place.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's really interesting, but as you say, it's quite a tricky thing, because I think a lot of people do that. Like, I can relate to that very heavily. I think I definitely do that about myself. So I guess it's, yeah, trying to dig into the feeling of when you're looking for, you know, flaws in yourself, whether they're not, I mean, I'm doing air quotes, nobody can see them, flaws, air quotes, and looking for that. Is it always a physical thing? Have you now transferred it onto your sort of personality traits? Why do you think you're always looking for something that's wrong? Is it because you're looking at other people, or is the judgment based more in something that happened in your past? Or, like, yeah, it's definitely a hard question to answer for us, especially not knowing more of someone's background. But I thought it was a really interesting question anyway, mainly because I related to it so much. And I think it is something that a lot of us do. So even if, you know, by answering this question, we can just... You said in your question, you were like, why do I do this? I think a lot of us do this. If that makes you feel any better, Marta, I think it's not, you know, it's not something that you specifically are weird for, or, you know, it's not something that you're doing that's bad. I think a lot of people do it.
For sure. Definitely. I mean, it's reminded me of a book that I mentioned in my book, but I really recommend it if you are interested in this topic. And it's called The Big Leap. It's by Gay Hendricks, who's an author in America, but it's all about how we all hit a limit sometimes on like our self-worth and our ability to like ourselves. And we hit that limit and then we try and like come back down again. And we all do that in so many other ways. And actually this question has sort of reminded me of, because I'm doing a bit of coaching at the moment one-on-one, which is when the real magic happens with things like this, where someone would just have friends that weren't very nice to her. And that was her thing. It was like, I keep like just having friends around me that aren't very nice to me. What's that about? And so it comes in all different forms and disguises, I think, this way of not really kind of breaking out of these cycles. So no, I think it's amazing that you asked that question. And yeah, you're not alone for sure.
Next question from Jimena, who asks, what are some examples of self-sabotage that you think are normalized but shouldn't be normal?
That's a good question. Well, I think I just touched on it there, actually, with friendships. I think we normalize having that friend who puts you down in a jokey way, or, you know, says things like, oh, I'm just brutally honest. That's just me.
Yeah.
And we've been friends since childhood, so I'm going to tell you what I really think about you. And actually, even though that's sort of someone else sabotaging you a little bit and your confidence, by being actively friends with people that put you down, that's normalized, I think, in our society. It's like, oh yeah, I've got friends that just put me in my place or whatever. But I don't know. I think friends should lift each other up. So I find friendship like such an interesting topic, especially after the pandemic and how we are looking at what we want from our friends.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, last question. This person didn't leave their name, but said, sometimes we're afraid of the unknown, resulting in not taking chances, but sometimes taking the chance has such a high risk that the self-sabotage might be a better option. My question is, where is the line between self-sabotage and the risk being too high? Hope that makes sense. So I think what I'm taking from that is, yeah, how do you tell when you are kind of sensibly sabotaging? Is there such a thing as that? Because yeah, there's a higher risk of failure. I don't know. I guess more of the idea of, if you think there's a goal that you're going to and it's not likely to happen, should you go for it anyway, or is that still sabotage if you don't?
It's a really good question. I think, again, it's kind of back to feeling. Like, what's the intention? How do you feel? And does it feel positive? Does it feel negative? Does it feel good inside? Or does it feel, do you feel really on edge? And actually the worst thing to do right now would be taking a massive life change, because actually maybe you want to actually spend some time sort of rooting yourself, getting yourself back to like a mental health state that you feel secure in. Do you know what I mean? I think it depends where you are in your life. But I think, you know, it's interesting because we can justify whatever we want to justify. That's what's funny about a human mind, is like you can justify absolutely anything. You're like, I'm doing this because of this or this or this. But it's like, I think I use this example in the book of, say you don't go on a date because you're worried that you might fall in love and then you will be heartbroken. And then you might be in bed for years because, you know, you might break up. You're kind of sabotaging yourself by not going and taking that big risk, because you're staying small and you're staying hidden. And I think this is the clue, I think, is if you're hiding, I think that's an element of sabotage. Whereas if you're just turning something down because you're like, that's not the right time in my life, that's empowering. And so it's sort of, it really depends where you are in your life, why you're doing it. You know, if tomorrow I quit my job because I'd fallen out with someone and I just quit my job, That'd be sabotaging myself, because why did I just quit? Like, it was fine. But if you quit your job and you have all these things lined up and you know it's right deep down and you know that it's like something that you are willing to risk, that feels different.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think if the thing is that you are shooting for a really high goal, whether it seems kind of likely or unlikely or whatever else, what is the point where it kind of becomes self-sabotage to keep going for it? That sounds like a really negative thing, but it kind of what you were saying before about the like sunk cost fallacy, that's, you know, quite a well-known idea. Did you come across much of that in your research as well, the kind of thing where it turns into where pursuing something is actually becomes sabotaging your life, even if it's not sabotaging that particular goal?
Yes, 100%. And I'm actually really interested in the weird cultural idea that like you should never quit anything, and like you're weak if you quit. That I grew up with that mentality of do not give up. And I'm looking around at lots of very ambitious people that I know who are done. They're like, I'm just, I don't want to do this anymore. And I find quitting so incredible and inspiring. When someone truly wants to quit, it's like you basically have chosen yourself and you've chosen your own self-care and your own health. And I just think that's really brilliant. And so, quitting when you truly want to is amazing. If you quit because you are making up all these excuses why you can't do it, but you know you can, you know you want to, that is sabotage. But quitting, I think, good for you if you want to.
If you want to know about opportunities to send in questions for upcoming guests, then follow us on Instagram or Twitter at goodinfluencegs. And you can email the podcast at goodinfluencepod@gmail.com. Before you go, I've got three things I ask every guest, and that's if listeners want to find out more about what we've been talking about today. Could you please recommend us something to read, something to listen to, and something to watch?
Yes. So on the topic of what we were discussing today, something to listen to, I absolutely love the One You Feed podcast. It's with a guy called Eric Zimmer, who was a heroin addict in his 20s, and he really overcame some major challenges, and he's just like a very inspiring person talking about sort of addiction and well-being and all that stuff. He's amazing. And there's a particular episode actually that if you like this topic, it's with a guy called Dr. Aziz Ghazipura, and he's the author of a book called On My Own Side, which is all about self-sabotage. It's all about inner critic stuff. It's a really big book. But I really recommend listening to the audio version if you really want to dive in, because it is long. Something to watch. I was thinking earlier about people who overcome obstacles in all kind of areas. And I don't know if you watched that Netflix documentary with Lady Gaga. I think it's called 5'2". But she has a lot of health conditions I don't think people really know about. Mm. And I just find her amazing. Like, she overcomes so many obstacles in her own way. And so if you want something kind of not necessarily related to what we're talking about, but someone really just sort of overcoming their own demons, I thought it was an incredible watch. It's amazing.
Oh, love that.
And then something to read. So there's a book, and it's not actually out till January. So I just wanted to flag it, really.
Okay.
And also this person in general to follow. So Natalie Liu, she is a boundaries coach. She talks a lot about, you know, saying no, taking back control, prioritizing yourself, a lot of the things we talk about in this episode. And she has a book coming out in January 2023 called The Joy of Saying No. But in the meantime, I really recommend following her Instagram and her website and things, because she's really helped me get back some space in my life.
Amazing. And of course, if you have enjoyed listening to Emma talk about sabotage, and like I said, there are a lot of tips and really like nice thought journeys in Emma's book called Sabotage, which we will link to in the show notes also. Thank you, as always, for listening, and thank you so much to Emma for joining me. If you enjoyed the episode, I'd love you to subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you're using to listen, and if you've got an extra minute, you can leave a rating and a review as well. Your reviews make a big difference and help other people find the podcast. See you next week!
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.